from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll cruise through the Dream Cars exhibit at the IMA.
I'll find out about a new anthology of women writers called Every Father's Daughter.
And I'll talk with the author of a biography of Indiana pilot Captain Cornish. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. If you live in Indianapolis, you can't help but be a little bit bitten by the car bug. Whether it's IndyCars, NASCAR, or classic Stutz automobiles, the Circle City has always been car crazy. That makes the Indianapolis Museum of Art the perfect venue for Dream Cars, innovative design, visionary ideas. The exhibit, organized by the IMA in conjunction with Atlanta's High Museum of Art, features rare European and American concept cars from the 1930s into the 21st century. Sharon Gamble spoke with award-winning automotive writer and co-curator Ken Gross.
We should define some terms to begin with. Where did this term dream car come from?
Well, it's attributed to Harley Earl, who was the head of styling for General Motors from the late 20s up through the 50s. And he started using the term, I think, in the late 1930s. And it's a pretty universal term because these cars, we also like to call them concept cars, are very much the stuff of dreams. They're a product of imagination. They don't necessarily or didn't necessarily have to be practical, but they had to point the way to the future. And in many ways, some of the people whose cars we're presenting at the IMA were definitely dreamers. They marched to, you know, to use that old cliche, they definitely marched to the beat of their own drum, and not everybody heard the notes. I think people will see that when they see some of these cars.
I love that even back in the 20s, that someone was responsible for styling. That's very forward-thinking.
Well, it was. Harley Earl, his father owned Earl Coachworks, and principally they built custom-bodied automobiles for celebrities in California. And also wealthy people as well, and he was discovered by one of the Fisher brothers, who of Fisher Body. They built bodies for General Motors. They felt that their styling was somewhat stagnant, and they really needed a breath of imagination. And Harley Earl had every bit of that. They brought him to Detroit, and he redesigned the 1927 LaSalle, looking for inspiration to the Hispano Suiza from Europe. It was a big success, and they let Earl set up his own studios, which he did. And not long afterward, Ford followed, and ultimately Chrysler did as well.
So I'm going to ask a question. I don't speak the mechanics of cars. I love the idea of style. Are concept cars primarily aimed at consumers like me? They're not about what's under the hood. They're about cool features, interesting silhouettes, that kind of thing?
Well, they can be both, to tell you the truth. In our exhibit, we have the General Motors Firebird 1, and it's a turbine-powered car that looks for all the world like a jet plane without wings.
Whoa.
And part of what the General Motors was looking to see was people's reaction to the notion of a gas turbine engine, literally a small jet engine, although the engine, unlike an airplane, the jet literally powers the plane. In this case, it powered a turbine, which turned the wheels in the simplest form. But they were interested to see how would people react in the early 1950s to the notion of an airplane for the road.
And what was the response?
Well, they built three different cars. They built the Firebird 1, and then they built and that's a single passenger car, so the notion wasn't particularly practical. Then they built a four-seater that was designed to run on a guided highway, but they didn't have the electronics yet to be able to build a guided highway, at least not in a practical sense. And finally, they did a two-seater with a bubble top that was also quite exciting, the Firebird 3. Bottom line, they didn't get particularly good fuel economy. The exhaust gas temperature was much too hot. Mm. Today they would know what to do about that, but in that era they weren't really able to. And there wasn't a crying need for inexpensive cars that ran and got high fuel mileage, not at that particular time. So there were a number of factors where it was a great styling exercise. I saw the I'm old enough, I hate to say, to have gone to the 1955 and 6 General Motors Motoramas, these giant shows. My dad took me in Boston as a young car enthusiast, and we were blown away by the notion of an aircraft for the street. Jet planes were still relatively new, and they were very exciting. And you looked at this car, and you thought, "Wow, it'll go 200 miles an hour, and it's got everything but machine guns on it."
It's going to revolutionize transportation,
right? It didn't. But some of the other General Motors cars, and we have several Motorama cars in our exhibition, did have an impact. We have a Buick Centurion from 1956, and the Buick has a panoramic see-through roof.
Ooh.
It has a television camera, so it didn't need rear-view mirrors. We thought that was extraordinary, a car without rear-view mirrors, particularly when TV in those days was in its infancy. So the notion of an automobile with a television that could see behind you, you know, was pretty incredible.
Pretty futuristic.
And the styling of this car was very exciting. So,
what's the oldest car in this exhibition?
The oldest car, I've got my book right here, so I can, is, we have actually a tie for old. We have the 1934 Voisin C25 Aerodyne sedan, and we have a 1934 Edsel Ford Model 40 Special Speedster. The Voisin was built by Gabriel Voisin, who was an aircraft pioneer and an aeronautical engineer who made a great deal of money in World War I selling aircraft to the French government and really wanted to do his own idea of a car. And he built a very modern-looking car with a shape like an airplane wing.
Ooh.
And Edsel Ford, who was the president of Ford Motor Company, Henry Ford was his father,
mm-hmm.
he wanted a special racy runabout for the street. And he could commission the Ford aircraft people and the head of his design, Bob Gregory, to build what amounted to a really sleek two-seater that that he could speed around Detroit with. The only problem was his father, Henry, did not like shows of ostentation with cars. So Edsel had to keep this car at his own home and drive it sparingly, lest his father be annoyed.
Aw. That actually brings up a question. Are all concept cars fully working, fully drivable?
They are and they're not. And by that I mean there were some that were never built to run. Our Buick Centurion has a beautiful engine, but it never ran. We had a Ferrari Modulo in the exhibit earlier, and it was not functional at all. But many of the others are. I mean, Edsel's Speedster is a very drivable car. One of the cars I think people will find fascinating is the Timms Special, which is a rear-engined, extraordinary-looking, very streamlined, elegant car that was built for his own personal use by Norman Timms, an Indianapolis race engineer whose cars won the Indy 500 in 47, 48, and 49. And this was his car for the road, so it was very functional. The problem was that every time Norman drove it, he attracted so many crowds and people that he finally got tired of it and sold the car. He didn't want that much attention.
That's the downside. Hey, I understand there's a 1936 car that eventually inspired what we now call a minivan, right?
Right. And once again, there was an aircraft engineer involved. This is William Bushell Stout, and the car was called a Scarab, which was very well named because it has a beetle shape.
Hmm.
The wheels are in the corners. The engine, which is a Ford V8, is in the back. And the passenger space can be reconfigured. You can move everything but the driver's seat. So, and there's also a table that folds out.
Oh, it's so like a living room.
Really, in that day. It has a wicker interior, which is really, really very cool. And the car, we know that 6 were made. There may have been 9. They were $5,000 in 1936, and you could buy a new Ford for under $700, Ford Deluxe sedan. So this was a $5,000 sounds like credit card money today, but it was a pretty heady sum in that era. And the shape of this car, while we look at it today and we understand it because we've seen minivans since the 1980s, but people in that era were used to cars being upright and blocky and somewhat square. So this car kind of was startling to them, and not everybody, between that and the price, not everybody went for it. In fact, very few people went for it.
So take me into the process. So I'm a car company, and I hire a bunch of designers. And if I'm smart, it sounds like I get an aircraft engineer or aircraft designer on my team, because I'm noticing a theme here. But we design a car. How do I know that it's been successful, or how do I track people's response? Is it a matter of going to the right car shows or getting the right press attention, or I guess I'm asking that across the history of concept cars?
Well, first of all, a great deal of research goes into modern cars today, much more so perhaps than they did back in the era that many of these cars were done. And but some of the principles have never really changed. I mean, you go from sketches, whether it's hand done or on a computer, to clay models. And ultimately to full-sized prototypes. And today they would have clinics. You know, they bring people in a controlled setting and look at a car. Oftentimes it doesn't have badges on it. They want to see what do you think, you know, what sort of thing. But the auto shows have always been a great way to gauge public reaction. Today, because it's expensive to do prototypes, they tend to be more closer to a production car than they were back in the day. General Motors in the 50s had its own rolling shows called the Motoramas that went all around the country, and they staged them in major auditoriums and buildings, and they were very interested in what people thought. So the concept cars were whirling around on turntables. They had new General Motors cars there, and salespeople, and they wanted to sell you a car. But part of what they wanted to do was see, what do you think of this panoramic windshield? You know, can you picture yourself in this car? And the message they were sending also was, we're showing you the cars of tomorrow. We'd like you to buy our cars today. But aren't you excited by the fact that this is a company that's looking so far into the future? And, you know, start with us now, stay with us. You'll always get a modern car. It was that sort of thing, to paraphrase.
It's kind of the dynamic around self-driving cars that people are starting to get psyched about today.
Well, that personally frightens me to death. But and I'm not a Luddite, I don't think, by any means. And I've seen these cars demonstrated, and it's pretty remarkable. But I think there's a lot that can go wrong. And in the meantime, cars today are so much fun to drive. I mean, even inexpensive cars have have decent handling and steering and stopping ability. So for the most part, I think, why wouldn't you want to drive?
I'm glad to hear you say that. I have what's referred to as a college car that for years they didn't advertise, which is a Honda Fit. And it's a blast to drive. So given, you've been steeped in cars since you were a little boy. What is your dream car? If you could, would it be something out of this exhibition that you'd like to drive right out of the museum and onto the road for yourself?
Jay Leno, who, as you know, is a big car collector.
Yeah.
People always ask him what his favorite is, and he always says, which one of your children is your favorite? So I have a favorite car in this exhibition, and I'll tell you really quickly that my favorite car is in my garage now, and I'm thrilled to have it. It's a 1932 Ford Roadster Hot Rod High Boy with a supercharged engine. It's a car that I collected pieces for, and we built exactly the way I wanted it. So I have that.
Sweet.
And that's cool.
Nice.
It actually it relates a little to Edsel's Speedster because some of the influences are the same. But in the exhibit, the car that I would most like to have is the Bugatti. And this is a 1935 Type 57S Aerolithe. The actual car debuted at the London and Paris Motor Shows in 1935, and it was like a spaceship when people saw it. It's swoopy and sleek and elegant. It has these interesting riveted seams because it was made of magnesium, and it was difficult to weld, so they actually riveted the pieces together. The car itself has been lost to time, and so the builders of this car, it's like, I call it a recreation. They have an authentic, in fact, the earliest Bugatti Type 57 chassis, Bugatti engine. It's all Bugatti. And then they went to the original company called Electron that made the magnesium panels, and they hand-formed the panels using computer measurements so that this car is an exact recreation of the car itself.
Wow.
And three production versions were made. Ralph Lauren owns one of them. And it's a car that's captivated me for forever. And I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm looking at my wall, and I have three different pictures of it. So
well, we'll try to distract the guards when you're in Indy, and we'll see what we can do to liberate
it. It's interesting. You know, it's owned by a fellow who, I can't quite call him a neighbor, but he lives 5 miles away from me. And so I think I'll have a chance to at least ride in it, if not drive it someday. I think people will be very captivated by it. The color is Bugatti called it creme de menthe, and it's like a pale, shimmering green. again, a color that wasn't particularly used in 1936. You know, cars were dark and somber.
Sure.
They were gray and dull, maybe an occasional red car. This car just, it glistens and glitters. I think visitors will be attracted to it like a magnet.
Sharon Gamble with Ken Gross. Along with Sarah Schuling, Ken curated Dream Cars, Innovative Design, Visionary Ideas. It's on view at the Indianapolis Museum of Art through August 23rd. Visit imamuseum.org for more information.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Just in time for Father's Day, a new anthology has come out titled Every Father's Daughter, 24 Women Writers Remember Their Fathers. It includes quite a variety of writers, including Jane Smiley and Alice Munro, as well as Barb Shoup and Susan Neville. Travis DiNicola spoke with Barb and Susan about the book.
Susan, Barb, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you both.
Great to see you too, Travis.
Glad to
be here.
Awesome to have you both, and congratulations on being part of this new anthology. This is a beautiful, beautiful book, and perfect timing, right? Just in time for a great Father's Day gift.
It is.
It could be. And so tell me a bit about this anthology. It's all women writing about their fathers, right, Susan?
Yeah, it is. It's a collection of essays, all written by women, all about their fathers, and it's an incredible lineup. It's really a privilege
we
to
are
be
in very
in
good
this
company
book.
In
we
this
are in
book.
Very good company. There's an essay by Jane Smiley, one by Bobby Ann Mason, an Alice Munro essay, a Barbara Shoup essay,
and a Susan Neville essay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Joe McCorkle. It's just an incredible,
some pretty heavy
anthology.
Hitters. I mean,
yeah.
Really well-known authors.
Very well-known.
And it's so cool to have some local authors who are also very well-known, and two of my favorites, be a part of this book. How did you get involved with being a part of the book?
Well, Margaret McMullen, mm-hmm. who is a force of nature, as anyone knows her, knows, it was her idea. She is a wonderful writer who lives here in Indiana, in mm-hmm. Evansville.
Mm-hmm.
And when her dad died several years ago, and she was just thinking about him a lot, she kind of got this idea that she would really love to put together a book of essays written by women about their fathers. And so in her usual sort of tornado fashion, she put it together, and she got Philip Lopate to do the introduction, who is a wonderful essayist and interesting. I thought it was interesting to choose a father to do
yeah.
the introduction instead of another woman. So it's Margaret's baby, and she's done a beautiful job with it.
That's
I think
very cool.
One of the sweetest essays actually in here is by Phil Lopate's daughter.
Right.
Which
Lily
was,
Lopate.
Yeah, Lily
yeah.
Lopate. So, yeah. And William Styron's daughter.
Yeah, well, you know, it's William Styron's daughter and... what is Breuillard Anatole Broyard.
His
daughter. So it's an interesting combination of
daughters of writers.
Daughters of writers and, you know, people who are coming from, you know, very, very well-to-do families. There's a really interesting issue by, or essay by a woman named Melora Wolfe, who, it's a we essay. And it's, you know, it's really New York. It's a very New York essay. And it has a sort of madman feel with the, you know, with the dads who are all dressed up in their suits, and the kids are all in private schools. And so you've got that, and then you've got people writing about their fathers who are truck drivers and all other kinds of things, too.
So really all over the place.
It's a great combo.
Yeah. Well, that's what an anthology should be, a great sampler where you can find some old favorites and discover new ones. Susan, tell me about the piece that you have in this.
The year that... that this anthology was being put together, my father died as well. And so I was working on a piece, or started to work on a piece for this anthology about his death. At the end of his life, he was a tail gunner in World War II. And he never talked about World War II, which is, it's interesting how many of the fathers in this book are kind of silent about their past or their childhood. But toward the end of his life, that's all he really wanted to talk about. He just kept telling us stories. He wanted to write his own memoir, and he wrote down things about being a tail gunner. And
why do you think he made that shift from not wanting to talk about it to talking about it?
I think it's realizing that it's the end of your life. Mm-hmm. And also you started watching so many of the men who are actually, they had been boys at the time. They were all 18, 19, 20 years old. His pilot was 21, and they thought of him as an old man. They all started dying and having reunions, and he had stories that he wanted to tell about it. I think he could also see his life as a sort of pattern or story, you know, kind of narrative. And that was probably the biggest part of it. And he'd been kind of quiet about it. And he kept a secret as well about World War II and being a tail gunner. He was in their flight when they went over Vienna, dropped a payload on the Vienna Opera House. And he was a musician himself, and so that was very, he felt the guilt for that at the same time that he always was, I think, felt, well, we felt pride in what, you know, in his service during World War II. But I think, as Vonnegut says, that, you know, when they came back from World War II, they were just Shortridge jerks, you know. They didn't feel that sense of...
Did he have a chance to write any of his story down, or...?
He did. He wrote it by hand in a notebook and gave it to me, and I typed it up for him and took it to Kinko's and made some copies and put photos of him. And the funny thing is, I remember my stepmother saying, John, you know, you wrote all of this about your life. It's your autobiography. It was quite short.
Yeah.
And it didn't include all those wonderful years we spent traveling the country in RVs. It was all about the war and, you know, the pictures of the planes and the...
Barb, your essay, tell me a bit about it.
My essay is called Waiting for My Father, and it starts off with myself at age probably about 4. And I used to wait for my dad at the back door. He would take the bus home from work, and I would stand there waiting for him at the door. And, you know, that feeling of joy when I would see him turn the corner. I was the oldest, and I really adored my dad. Mm-hmm. And what my essay really explores, my dad's alcoholism, which, as time went on, became a real problem for him. Mm-hmm. And, I felt like I lost the dad that I had when I was a little girl, and it wasn't until many years later that I understood that even while my dad was alive, I felt just a lot of grief about that. And so my essay, I think, also sort of explores what might have happened had it been different. And, you know, this is the way it was, but it could have been this, or this. And I wrote about it in the context of thinking about how you write stories. You know, what if this would happen? What if that would happen? And looking at all the different alternatives. And my dad had a happy ending. He did become sober near the end of his life, and he had some very happy years, he and my mom in Florida. So that was great. But the dad I had never quite came back, and that's, you know, that's just a sadness to me. And there's a lot of sadness in these essays, which I think is interesting. Whether you had a happy, really wonderful relationship with your dad, it seems like people are just thinking, you know, I'm grown up now. That's lost, and so that even though the essays are all very true, don't you think, Susan?
Yeah.
They're very honest and not depressing, really, but just they're honest, and I think they're great food for thought for anybody who wants to think about their own fathers, or for fathers who want to think about their relationship with their daughters and what those daughters might think 10, 20, 30 years from now about how they saw him and how they came to see him over the years. Very powerful stuff.
Did you write yours specifically for this, or had you been working on it already?
Yeah, I did. So I was thankful to Margaret, because I'm always happy when someone asks me to do something that I never would have thought of doing in a million years.
Hmm. How about you, Susan? Was this also written specifically?
It was also written specifically for this. So love writing prompts.
Mm-hmm. Which really it is.
Yeah, it is.
Well, how much were you given? Was it basically just write an essay about your dad, or was there more to it than that? Or just kind of
that
open?
Was very open-ended. Yeah. And the essays are really different. Some are really short. Patricia Henley, who's an Indiana writer, hers is just a couple of pages, and it's really just a memory, a very vivid memory. And then others are quite long.
Hmm. That's great. Now, is there an opportunity for all the authors to get together and meet and talk, or this was pretty much all done by correspondence? Or
That's what this thing is. Well, we don't have an opportunity, you know, in person to get together, although a bunch of people were at the Associated Writing Programs conference a couple of weeks ago, and there was a really nice reading there, so that was a little bit of an opportunity. But what we're doing on Saturday is kind of a group launch, which is something unusual. So there will be
multiple launches in
different
cities
all over
the
country. And so we'll be doing some Skyping, and I'm not sure what all, but it'll be something a little bit different and interesting.
That'd be kind of cool. And of course, here in Indianapolis, it's going to be at Indy Reads Books from 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturday. And Margaret's going to be there as well. Right?
Margaret's going to be here. Susan's going to be here. I'm going to be here. There. And another writer from the book who is named Jessica Woodruff.
Okay.
And she's a very young writer, which I think is really cool, too. Yeah. A beginning emerging writer.
Very cool. Very cool. So what is next for both of you while I have you here? Susan, what are you working on now that you can share with us?
Well, the Indiana Bicentennial is coming up. So
yes.
For the past few weeks, I've been working on writing prompted essays and pieces for different projects that are coming up with that. I've written a longer version of the essay in this book, and I'm working on revising it, and that's what I'm working on now.
Very cool. Very cool. And Barb?
I'm finishing up a couple of novels that have been in process for a long time, and I'm hoping to get those things finished and off my desk so that I can do something new. I really like to write some more essays. I enjoy that. It's an interesting time of life to do that.
Of course, good stuff going on at the Writer Center as well.
Always lots of good stuff going on. Yeah, we've got some good classes coming up. In fact, I'll tell you what a few of them are. We've got this Saturday, Embrace Science in Your Writing. We've got a big basic book design class coming up, which I think will be of interest to a lot of people. Poetry, fiction, a novel workshop. I'm teaching a Get Started class on June 15th in the evening. So if you don't know what you want to do, but you do know you want to write, that's a good one to sign up for. And we're happy to be offering classes for middle school and high school students this summer, which we haven't done for a long time.
And people can get information on your website?
www.indianawriters.com.
Very good. Well, Susan, Barb, always a pleasure to see you both. I love reading your work. I love having the chance to chat with both of you. And congratulations on being part of Every Father's Daughter.
Thank you so much.
Travis DiNicola with authors Barb Shoup and Susan Neville. They're featured in the new anthology, Every Father's Daughter, 24 Women Writers Remember Their Fathers. The book launch will take place this Saturday, May 23rd, from 4 to 6 p.m. at Indy Reads Books. More information is available at indyreadsbooks.org, and that's up at 911 Mass Ave. Hey, Travis.
Yeah, Sharon.
Woo!
Nicely done. But you know what? If they start racing electric cars at the speedway, there'll be no sound to make on the radio.
Oh, that'll be so wrong.
It will be.
Maybe they'll race that electric egg car from the Dream Cars exhibit.
Ooh, that
I
would
love
be very
that
cool.
One. It
That'd
would be
awesome.
Very cool. It wouldn't go very fast, but it'd be
amusing.
Love
to see a race of the concept cars. Well, obviously, it is race weekend, but there's so much more going on in the city and around the state, and that's what we're here to talk about on the calendar we call...
What do we do for Memorial Day weekend?
Yes, well, so actually, I'm projecting ahead a little bit, I must admit.
Yes.
Because there's an event going on down at Brown County at the Bean Blossom site, the Bill Monroe Music Park and Campground. And it just sounds like fun. It's the most laid-back festival in America, also known as the John Hartford Memorial Festival. Hartford was sort of the father of newgrass music, updated bluegrass, and it's going on May 28th through the 30th. And you can go down there and camp and or just bring your lawn chairs and hang out for a little while or for the whole weekend. But it is billed as the three-day family-friendly, most laid-back festival in America. What more do you need?
I saw Johnny Hartford perform once. That's a great description.
Yeah,
he was
cool.
Awesome. And he would do like a percussion skiffle dance with his feet while he was playing and singing. Really, really fun.
Well, they've got 40 performers, three stages, jamming, songwriting contest, old-time fiddle contest. Sounds like a good time down Bean Blossom. Should be a lot
of fun.
That's
delightful. Hey, if you have relatives in town who are like, hey, who do I know in Indianapolis? I want to go to the race and I want to stay somewhere besides a hotel. You might have a house full of guests right now. And of course, I'm sure you're going to do Memorial Day related things because that is appropriate. It is, after all, a holiday in addition to the kickoff of summer. But if you're looking for something to do that might be a little bit different, you want to dazzle them, literally and figuratively, consider going over, well, of course, the Dream Cars exhibit that you just heard about at the IMA. But while you're there, go to the Oldfields Estate, because the Tiffany Gorham and Height of American Silver exhibit is on view right now with more than 60 exceptional pieces of 19th and 20th century silver. And this exhibit explores a pretty great breadth of the silver-making legacy of the United States and of England as well. So Tiffany Gorham and the Height of American Silver on view at the IMA. Take your guests there.
That was a really interesting interview you had with Charles, director of the IMA. Very cool that he curated that.
Yeah.
Hey, if you happen to find yourself playing some croquet on this holiday weekend and you're thinking, you know what? I am so good, I should be in a competition. Well, we've got one for you. It's the Wicked World of Croquet, which is coming up next weekend on Saturday, May 30th. It benefits the Benjamin President Harrison Presidential Site. I'm trying to get that name
easy
right.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, I know. There you go. on Delaware Street and their education programs. You can still register a team. There are registrations available for both the competitive bracket and the leisure bracket. And play starts at 1 o'clock, and it will be a lovely afternoon to wear your whites and play some croquet at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site.
Fantastic. Love it. Hey, also going on next weekend, a couple of home tours to point out to you. The Back to the Future Mid-Century Modern Home Tour Indiana Landmarks puts together every year. It's in Muncie this year on Saturday, May 30th. You can find more information at indianalandmarks.org. And the historic Meridian Park Neighborhood Home Tour is going on Saturday the 30th and Sunday the 31st. And you can find out more about that at historicmeridianpark.org. A lot of homes as well as some gardens on view on that tour.
Very cool. Hey, planning a little bit ahead, June 2nd, Taylor Martin's Indie Magic Monthly Show is doing their annual Barely Legal Show. What does that mean? Not what it sounds like. Basically, these are young magicians who are going to be performing at Theater on the Square on June 2nd. Show starts at 7:30. Nathan Cowell, Brendan Ware, Anthony Stockton, and Eli, all young magicians under the age of 16 who are going to be performing that night. Should be fun.
Cool. Hey, something else going on this very weekend, if you're hearing us Thursday Thursday night. This Friday night is the inaugural Crescendo partnership between the Indianapolis Opera and the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. It's a free concert at 7:30 at the Lawn at White River State Park, featuring opera's greatest hits, Broadway show tunes, symphonic pops, and Indiana favorites. Learn more at Crescendo 2015.com. On Eventbrite. Just type in Crescendo 2015 on Eventbrite.
And you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next weekend on
What Will We Do? Go fast, turn left.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Clarence Cornish, nicknamed Cap, was an Indiana pilot whose life spanned all but 5 years of the 20th century. Amazingly, he was a pilot for most of those years. Cap Cornish devoted his life to flight and its many uses and opportunities. Aided by copious documents Cap left behind, his daughter, Ruth Ann Ingraham, has written a biography that portrays his colorful life. Sharon Gamble invited Ruth Ann in to talk about Cap Cornish, Indiana pilot, navigating the century of flight.
So I'd like for you to start by reading one of the treasure trove of letters that you inherited.
I did inherit about 135 letters that my father wrote during World War I, from the time he entered in 1917, April of, until he was released in January of 1919. Hmm. And he really became hooked on flying. And this, I think, is probably, this is a quote from him, from a letter that he wrote to his family in Fort Wayne. And he was down in Mississippi at this time on his way to a base in Florida. Usually, there were four or five of us up there at the same time, playing around among the clouds. And let me remind you that he's in a very primitive aircraft, a Jenny, what was called a Jenny. Mm-hmm. And doing stunts as we felt like it. In other words, completely shut off from the ground below by a soft, intangible mass of something white. And, well, I can't describe it. And just naturally enjoying ourselves. Up there that way makes you feel that you are way off somewhere in a land far remote from this little globe of ours, and in the land of, as he put it, fairies. It is as if the heavens opened up and we sailed into a new sphere. You sail down a ravine between two high banks of clouds, around and up a side cut in one of the banks, and probably come out into a big valley with clouds for a ground. And higher and fleecy, flimsy ones above, and the sun shining bright and serene on the whole scene. Then again, maybe, another plane will sail out into this valley from somewhere. You circle toward each other, wave a greeting, and pass on. At a little distance apart, one will do some stunt and then the other. Then after another greeting, sail on out of little peaceful valley to play around among the hills and vales once more. These hours are made up of seconds never to be forgotten and frame a picture of such a wonderful, peaceful serenity, and such a picture that no one can begin to appreciate unless he has actually seen this enacted. But having seen and felt, I am greatly impressed by it. And so I've endeavored to put into a few colorless and insufficient words what I saw there above, yet among the clouds yesterday.
Wow. So you know, it's important to remember too. This is before. A lot of inventions that have to do with flight. This is when people were in open cockpits.
Definitely open cockpits.
No radio communications. So no. If another flyer is up there, you literally do wave to that person.
That's exactly right. Radio communication came later for them.
Do you remember, it's always hard for a child to know what normal life is, but do you remember a moment when you became aware that your dad's life was a little different from a lot of the other dads among your friends?
Well, he certainly was the only pilot or the father who was a pilot from among my friends. I will say that. And at the time when I was growing up, we were both in World War II in Washington, D.C., and then in Indianapolis when he was director of the Aeronautics Commission and flew all over the state to check in with base airports and people who managed airports and flying farmers and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and he did a Girl Scout badge for my Girl Scout troop, and so that was unusual.
Yeah.
Nobody else could do that.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What do we know about his very first flight?
His very first flight was in Tennessee at Park Field. This was in May of 1918. He had entered the war, and as I said, in April of 1917, when he was a senior in high school, and did ground school in Champaign, Urbana, and then went on to be a pilot. So that first flight, he was with a very famous pilot. It was a two seat Jenny, and so he went up with a man named Billy Brock, who was a man who was very accomplished in aviation and set records later on. But he described it as sort of like being in a canoe on a choppy lake.
Mm-hmm.
We can all kind of relate to that, even
sure.
when we're in big jets today flying. There are times when it's pretty bumpy and
choppy. When you're gripping the armrest.
Right.
Yeah.
But just remember that at the time there were no paved airstrips or taxiways, so the landings that they did were on sod, and the planes themselves were fragile and broke, and grasses would get tangled in the wheels. And he was just happened to be one of those lucky ones who was, I think, was born to be a pilot and survived when other people didn't.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's so remarkable about this book and his story, which of course comprises the book, is that he flew pretty much the better part of a century and
yes,
saw astonishing changes in technology.
Absolutely. So he began flying, Sharon, in 1917, and his last flight was in 1995.
Wow.
And it occurred 18 days before he died at the age of 97. And in a way, just to regress a little bit, that's why the book is, the title includes Navigating the Century of Flight, because he was born in the 19th century and died at the end of the 20th century. And that flight, when he was age 97, put him in the Guinness Book of World Records and as being the world's oldest actively flying pilot, and he remained so until for a few years after that.
Wow.
So, yes, he flew for what? How many? 70?
Yeah.
Over 70 years.
Yeah. And
and did see so many changes.
Right.
In every way.
And he, you know, it's one thing to have the technical abilities and instincts to actually pilot a plane. It's another thing to understand what the field means. And your dad was a pioneer in understanding what flight could mean to the world and in particular to Indiana and in particular, more specifically, to Fort Wayne.
More specifically to Fort Wayne in northeast Indiana. That's where he lived from the age of two until World War II in 1942. So he was there when they were first thinking of having a municipal airport in the mid-1920s and then continued to help with that development for what is now Smithfield. It's still a historic landmark and it's still an active airfield today, which is very exciting, actually.
And
it's
in a little unusual
condition,
yeah.
And well used.
Yeah.
So, he was the interesting thing about his career in aviation was that it was not only a military career, but it was a civil career. So he did not fight abroad in either war, but he was involved in both worlds, World Wars I and II. In the military, but he was also very involved in civil aviation. Mm-hmm. So he had both those experiences, and one led to and helped with the other.
You have some fascinating details in the book about something that I don't remember learning in history class, but that the coasts of the United States were not as safe as we think they were in World War II.
Definitely not. And so that was what he was involved with primarily during World War II was keeping the navigables, helping with others to maintain safety in the navigable space among the above the continental United States. And, you know, we don't think about that.
Right.
But it was fascinating for me to learn about it. I knew very little about it before I started doing the research for this book.
Did you know before you inherited all these, I said treasure trove at the top of the interview,
yes.
It really is your father was like, had the historian chromosome, it sounds like. Did you know that he had all of these materials?
No. I certainly didn't know about the 135 letters that he had written to his family during World War I. When you consider that was over, a 20-month period of time, and he wrote 135 letters, it was almost like a journal.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was all the way from smoking his first cigars to the beautiful girls that he met along the way to his first flight.
Sure.
And his training. But, I mean, certainly he had received notoriety and he had been interviewed by the Indiana Historical Society, so an hours long interview. So I knew that there was interest and that what he had done was worthy of historic proportions.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly didn't fathom the quantity and the depth of the materials, including everything chronologically ordered in binders of all the correspondence that he had during World War II and as director of the Aeronautics Commission. So not only are all the letters that he sent in chronological order, but also the carbon copies and also the receipt of mail. So it's all there, all of the speeches in mimeographed, I think is probably what they were. And so it was that, the quantity and the depth of the materials that I discovered after he died in 1995, that it occurred to me that there was really something to be told here, that it needed to be done.
Right.
Because of his history in Indiana and nationally even. And I was the one to do it.
Right. Beyond the tangible items you just talked about, what did you inherit from your father? What did you recognize in telling his story? What did you recognize in yourself?
Oh, I probably have even, there's I probably even stated this in the book, that he did have a particularly rough time in the 1950s when I was in high school, the only child of my parents. He had a political position as director of aeronautics for the state of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he was politically relieved of that position in the 1950s. He had been in aviation related since the late the teens,
right.
the 19-teens. So now we're near the mid-1950s, and he's in his mid to late 50s and was without a job.
Hmm.
And he was very discouraged and couldn't see the future. And I was getting ready to go to college. He had a daughter who was anticipating going to college. And so that was hard. But then he went into a totally new field, which was aviation insurance, and eventually owned his own aviation insurance business and continued flying on the anniversary of his first flight and, you know, did remarkable things. So, and was a volunteer with the boys' school in Plainfield and did a lot of community service after that. So for me, it was an example of, yep, you can be knocked down, but you can also, you know, get back up, stand up, and keep going. And so I think it was that
resilience.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Excellent word.
Sharon Gamble with Ruth Ann Ingraham, author of Cap Cornish, Indiana Pilots Navigating the Century of Flight. You can find this colorful biography at the Basile History Market at the Indiana History Center, as well as at Amazon.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll catch up with DJ Kyle Long to find out about some cool music events this summer, including the work he's doing with Eskenazi Hospital.
Excellent. I'll get a preview of the new Bob Direx production, Jesus Christ Superstar.
And I'll chat with artist Lois Templeton about her current show at Gallery 924. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.